1,000 Palestinians in Al-Quds so far this year as the regime continues its drive to Judaize the occupied city. And Niger's junta has accused France of planning to destabilize the West African nation by creating a climate of insecurity. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has ruled out the possibility of direct talks with his Turkish counterpart as long as Turkish occupation forces are present in the Arab country. Here he is.
Why would Erdogan and I meet? To drink beverages? Our goal is Turkey's withdrawal from Syrian territory, while Erdogan's goal is to legitimize the presence of Turkey's occupation in Syria. Therefore, the meeting cannot take place under Erdogan's conditions.
Made the remarks while speaking in an interview with Sky News. Assad said terrorism is the reason behind the destruction in Syria, adding those who supported terrorists and brought the war on Syria are responsible for the country's current situation, not those who fought the terrorists. On Syria's reconstruction, Assad said the biggest obstacle to the return of millions of refugees is lack of infrastructure, which was all devastated by over a decade of war. He said it takes time to revive the Syrian economy and trade.
The biggest obstacle is the destruction of the infrastructure by terrorists. The biggest obstacle is the image of war in Syria that prevents any investor from coming to deal with the Syrian market. The biggest obstacle also is that you can destroy economic relations in weeks or months, but you need years in order to restore them. So it's unrealistic to expect that these relationships, which have begun to look closer to normal, would lead to economic results within months.
Assad added, U.S. sanctions are another major obstacle to reconstruction efforts, although Syria has managed to bypass many of them. On Israeli attacks on Syria, Assad said attacks are carried out under the pretext of countering Iranian presence in the Arab country, but they in fact target the Syrian army. He said Israeli strikes started when Assyrian forces began to achieve victory in their battle against terrorists. Newly released figures suggest Israel's drive to Judaize the occupied Palestinian city of Al-Quds continues unabated as part of the regime's ethnic cleansing policy. The Palestinian Prisoner Center for Studies says Israel has issued almost 900 forced expulsion orders for Palestinian residents of Al-Quds since the beginning of this year. According to the center, most Palestinians targeted by the decision live in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the old city of Al-Quds, and other nearby areas. Regime has also detained a total of 2,000 Palestinians in Al-Quds since the beginning of 2023. Figures include 465 minors and 58 women, as well as the sick and the elderly. Number of arrests in Al-Quds accounts for about 50% of all Palestinians arrested across the occupied territories. Israel has also sentenced more than 550 Palestinians to life in prison. As the world marks International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, the plight of indigenous Palestinians remains an ongoing concern. Ashraf Shannon has your story in this report.
As the world marks the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, over 5 million Palestinian refugees are still displaced and are scattered all over the world. In 1948, Israeli forces uprooted hundreds of thousands of indigenous Palestinians from their ancestral lands and replaced them by Jewish settlers. Some 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The majority of Palestinian refugees in Gaza are grappling with poverty and rely on aid from local and international agencies to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates are very high among Palestinian refugees in the tiny seaside territory.
One day we will return to our towns and villages. We have been living in harsh conditions for 75 years amid the silence of the international community. Poverty, unemployment, and sickness are widespread among the refugees. Just look around you. Our living condition is miserable. Israel is responsible for our suffering.
Press TV visited the house of Shwekar Dola, an 85-year-old refugee from the Palestinian city of Jaffa, currently known as Tel Aviv. Shwikar, who lives in the Shati refugee camp, says she has not lost hope of returning to Jaffa.
In 1948, Israeli forces attacked our city and started killing people, including women and children, and I lost many members of my family. My family escaped to Gaza, and I was only 10 years old. We have been living in the refugee camp for 75 years, but I still have the dream of returning to my city, or at least being buried there. Even if I don't return, my children and grandchildren will return.
In 1948, 85% of the Palestinian population faced displacement and dispossession, and over 500 villages were destroyed, a somber chapter in the establishment of the Israeli regime. Officials have been repeatedly calling on the international community to help the Palestinian refugees.
The Israeli occupation has made life unbearable for Palestinians since 1948. On this day, indigenous Palestinians continue to live under dire humanitarian conditions after decades of losing their towns and villages, and Palestinian refugees are still scattered in refugee camps. Palestinian refugees were forced at gunpoint to leave their homes in 1948. Sincere international action is needed to help Palestinian refugees.
Palestinians continue to suffer under Israel's occupation and constant human rights violations since 1948.
After more than seven decades of displacement, Palestinian refugees say they hold sacred the right to return to their original lands. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Niger's junta has accused the country's former colonial power, France, of planning to destabilize the West African nation. Junta said in a statement that France has violated Niger's airspace, attacked a military camp, and freed terrorists to use them in attacks on border military positions. It added France is trying to create a climate of insecurity to undermine the credibility of the junta in the eyes of the people. France has rejected the accusation, saying overflights by its aircraft were part of an earlier agreement with Nigerian forces. It also denied attack on a Nigerian military camp. Junta has revoked a number of military agreements with France after toppling President Mohamed Bazoum on July 26. On Thursday, heads of state of the West African bloc, known as ECOWAS, are scheduled to meet in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, to discuss Niger, including the possible use of force to restore the former president. Iran's foreign minister has departed Tehran for Pretoria to attend the 15th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the Islamic Republic and South Africa. A commission is scheduled to convene Thursday in its first gathering since outbreak of the COVID pandemic. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says he'll also hold meetings with his South African counterpart and president. His trip comes just ahead of the Iranian president's visit later this month. Ebrahim Raisi will travel to South Africa at the invitation of his counterpart to take part in a BRICS summit. South Africa currently holds the rotating chairmanship of the group, which consists of major emerging economies. Iran applied for BRICS membership last year.
Iran has hosted a conference dubbed Iran and BRICS Prospects for Partnership and Cooperation at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies in the capital, Tehran. Officials from the ministry, as well as a group of foreign ambassadors residing in the Iranian capital, participated in the event, which aims at identifying mutual capacities between the sides. The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is often seen as an alternative to Western economic and political hegemony. It accounts for 42% of the global population and about 26% of the world's economy. Addressing the conference, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian highlighted the significant role of BRICS in driving global economic growth, saying the Islamic Republic can be a reliable and influential partner of the five-member bloc of emerging economies.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
The foreign minister hailed the favorable state of Iran's political and economic relations with BRICS members and underlined the need for all sides to further boost economic ties. He also stressed that BRICS represents a powerful economic and political synergy with the potential to influence regional and global developments. The BRICS summit will be held in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 22nd to 24th. According to South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, among the topics to be discussed at the BRICS summit will be the organization's expansion. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has received a formal invitation from South Africa to attend the summit. Iran is among dozens of countries that seek membership in the BRICS and has submitted a formal application to join the body.
Now, as a result of a global shift away from multi-unilateralism, that is, more and more countries have joined or seek to join international economic mechanisms belonging to a multilateralist front, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS Group.
For decades after the Cold War, the world witnessed a U.S. unipolar hegemonic order. In recent years, however, a new multipolar world order has been emerging, with certain countries challenging the U.S.'s economic and political dominance. Also, perceptions of American arrogance and hypocrisy are widespread. Trust in the international systems that the U.S. helped invent and has presided over since World War II is long gone. After two decades of bloody military interventions across the West Asia, namely in Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States has lost much of its moral credibility as well. Russian and Chinese leaders have long expressed a desire for a more multipolar order, as have the leaders of emerging powers such as India or Brazil. So has Iran. And for the Islamic Republic, BRICS can be the next significant target of its multilateralism policy. According to the latest data released by the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, the value of Iran's non-oil trade with BRICS group of countries hits $38.43 billion in the 2022-2023 fiscal year, showing a 14% hike compared to the same period a year earlier. That's while the West, particularly the U.S., have imposed several rounds of unilateral sanctions against Tehran. Many states have been applying for membership in international bodies in a bid to promote multilateralism and counter unilateral policies. In addition, last month, Iran gained full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. In an address to a meeting of the Friends of BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town in June, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran is among the pioneers of multilateralism. He added that the era of unilateralism is coming to an end and that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS group of countries will play major roles in the future as a new world order is emerging.
The British Home Secretary has leveled accusations against Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, claiming it poses a threat to UK security. Iran has rejected the allegations as baseless, saying it's the UK that's brought instability to the region of West Asia. Our correspondent, Robert Carter, reports from London.
London has sparked a new row with the Islamic Republic of Iran this week after Home Secretary Suella Braverman was quoted by British media claiming Iran poses the UK's biggest security threat. Sources close to the Home Secretary attributed quotes to her, including,
"The Iranian threat is the one that worries us the most. It's a big issue because they're getting much more aggressive and their appetite is increasing."
Following this, similar comments were later released by Number 10, adding,
"We think that the behavior of Iran, including the actions of the IRGC, poses a significant threat to the safety and security of the UK and of our allies."
On Monday, Iran responded sharply, rejecting the UK's hostile accusations as baseless. There's a growing dispute within the British government whether the UK should add Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, also known as the IRGC, to Britain's terrorism list. The group is a key component in Iran's military and has been credited with upsetting US foreign policy across the West Asia region for several decades. Israel has also repeatedly leveled what Iran considers baseless accusations against the IRGC and its activities. However, for most Iranians, the IRGC is considered a vital counter-terrorism unit that played a key role in protecting Iran and the region from security threats.
ISIS, fundamentally backed by the Americans and the British and the French, expanded very rapidly under their watch and facilitated as well. The only thing that really stopped them in their tracks was, number one, Ayatollah Sistani in Iraq and his call for the Hashd-e Shahabi, or the defense of Iraq. And without the Iranian military know-how and the backup of the likes of Haji Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force at that time, there would be no Iraq as we know it today. You have no Navy presence of the Iranians in and around British waters. You can't say the same about Britain. They have a huge Navy presence in Bahrain, in the Straits of Hormuz itself, threatening Iran very, very directly. You have no missile reach. The Iranians have no missile reach to the streets of London. You cannot say the same about Britain. It's Britain which has the threat to Iran.
Iranian officials have made absolutely clear that the IRGC is a red line issue and have warned against any proscription of the group as terrorist. They added that they consider the IRGC a key military group which has played a large role in the defense of the West Asia region. However, despite this, the UK has taken a hostile stance, with the Foreign Secretary James Cleverly insisting on further sanctions instead. Robert Carter, London.
U.S. has announced new restrictions on American investments in a number of Chinese high-tech sectors. Beijing says it's very disappointed with the decision. The Chinese embassy in Washington said the curbs will seriously undermine the interests of Chinese and American companies. China's Commerce Ministry also expressed grave concern about the new restrictions, urging U.S. to respect laws of the market economy and principles of fair competition. This after President Joe Biden issued an executive order to restrict investment in China's high-tech sectors, especially semiconductors and artificial intelligence. Biden argued that such investments may accelerate development of sensitive technologies in countries that use them to counter the U.S. and its allies. The Treasury Department also alleged China could exploit U.S. investments to produce technologies critical to military modernization.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's policies have often forced Palestinian families apart. Parents in Gaza sometimes have to bring up children alone, while the other parent works and lives in the West Bank. As a result, families are only able to keep in touch by telephone or the internet. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Soheir Hanoun is unable to see her mother. Raised in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, where her mother still lives, Soheir moved to Gaza more than two decades ago. In 2021, the Israeli regime military informed Soheir that she had to sign a document after visiting her mother. The document was mostly in Hebrew, a language Soheir does not understand. When she asked what the document contained, the Israeli troops at Erez, the military checkpoint separating Gaza and the occupied territories of Palestine, refused to say. The Zionist regime troops just told Soheir that if she did not sign, she would not be allowed to enter Gaza and see her husband, Ibrahim, and their children. A few days later, Soheir showed the document to a human rights group. She was shocked when she heard what she had consented to by signing it. The document was effectively a declaration that Soheir was making Gaza her permanent residence. She would not be allowed to enter the West Bank again unless she submitted a relocation application. Soheir, who is in her late 40s, has tried to visit her mother since signing the document. But the Zionist regime has repeatedly rejected her request for travel permits. She did file a relocation application in the hope of being allowed to live in the West Bank. But the Zionist regime rejected her request. Soheir said, "It feels like I have been exiled." She had been planning to move to the West Bank with her children. Doing so, she added, was necessary to give the children a happy future away from all the attacks on Gaza and the hard living conditions they have experienced. The Zionist regime began pressuring people from the West Bank entering Gaza via the Erez checkpoint to sign permanent residence declarations in 2009. Although the obligation to sign such papers was dropped after a few years, the Zionist regime has recently reintroduced it. Even before she was forced to sign the declaration, Soheir had trouble getting permits for travel between Gaza and the West Bank. She has only seen her mother and siblings in Nablus twice since moving to Gaza in 2002. The first occasion was in 2011 when her mother, diagnosed with diabetes, had health problems. The second one in 2021 when one of the Soheir siblings underwent upon open heart surgery. At other times, the Israeli regime would not allow her to travel. As a result, she was unable to attend her father's funeral in 2008 and her brother's wedding in 2016. Earlier this year, the human rights group Al-Mizan reported that more than 100 women and children have submitted applications so they could move from Gaza to the West Bank. Some of the requests were made more than a decade ago, yet the Zionist regime has still not processed them. The Zionist regime's policies have often forced Palestinian families apart. Parents in Gaza sometimes have to bring up children alone, while the other parent works and lives in the West Bank. As a result, families are only able to keep in touch by telephone or the internet. The cruel permit regime enforced by the Zionist regime violates free movement rights enshrined in international humanitarian law. Salih Abu Jumeza hardly ever sees her father Qasem except via video call. Qasem moved from Gaza to the West Bank about 13 years ago, finding work in a clothing factory. Salih, now in her mid-20s, got married in March. Qasem was not able to attend the wedding. "He had no choice," said Qasem's wife and Salih's mother, Tasahil, adding, he can only attend family occasions via video call. As soon as he moved to the West Bank, Qasem filed an application so his family could join him there. But the Zionist regime has never granted him the required permission. Since moving to the West Bank, Qasem has visited his family in Gaza just 3 times. Each visit only lasted a few days. The travel permits issued to him by the fabricated regime of Israel would have expired if he stayed any longer. 4 years have passed since his last trip. Qasem fears that the Zionist regime would prevent him from leaving Gaza and that he would thereby lose the chance of re-entering the West Bank. To Sahil, his wife says, he has been trying to get the family back together for years. He doesn't want to destroy those efforts by spending 3 days in Gaza, even if it means sacrificing his happiness.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us enlighten our minds with this wonderful saying from the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. There are 70 advantages for saying salam, that is, peace upon you. 69 for the one who greets first, and 1 for the person who responds to the greeting.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how the Salah is the Mi'raj and the ascension of the mu'min, the believer. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service. In today's episode, we are talking about how the Salah, the wajib obligatory daily prayers, which are five in number, are the Mi'raj of the mu'min. Now, what a beautiful statement, and this is the statement that we find in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. And this statement is that the Salah is the Mi'raj of the mu'min. The Salah, meaning the five daily prayers, the wajib prayers first and foremost, and then, of course, the recommended prayers as well, but the focus is primarily on the five daily prayers, the wajib prayers, are said to be the Mi'raj of the mu'min. So we want to talk a little bit about, of course, this concept of Salah being the Mi'raj of the mu'min in our Islamic lifestyle. So when talking about an Islamic lifestyle, and we are talking about how to live an Islamic lifestyle and breathe an Islamic lifestyle, of course, one of the fundamental pillars is this Salah, which is the Mi'raj of the mu'min. So Mi'raj here is an allusion to the spiritual and some say spiritual and physical ascension of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, towards the heavens, where he reached a point where he was in this Qaba Qawsain, is what it is known as, meaning he was so close to the Almighty Allah that even the angel Gabriel could not go as far and as close to the Almighty Allah as the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, was able to go. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the statement that the Salah is the Mi'raj of the mu'min, and once we realize what this means, that the Salah, the wajib, daily, obligatory prayers are the Mi'raj of the mu'min, then of course we will implement it into our Islamic lifestyle. So Mi'raj, we were saying, was an allusion towards the spiritual and physical, as we said, according to some, ascension of the Messenger of Allah past the heavens, the seven heavens as they are known, and reached a proximity and a nearness and a qurba to the Almighty Allah that even the archangel Jibra'il, Gabriel, was not able to get that close to the Almighty Allah. So this is Mi'raj. And mu'min, of course, is the believer. So when we put all of these statements together, these wajib, daily, obligatory prayers are a spiritual and physical ascension of the believer in order to attain the nearness and the qurba of the Almighty Allah. And so you start to realize the incredible importance and the great status and value of these daily prayers. And of course, it is via these daily prayers that the mu'min, the believer, will be able to reach the heights of spirituality. And so truly we must pay attention to the salah, the mi'raj of the mu'min, in our Islamic lifestyle if we want to truly live and breathe an Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Nuclear scientists entered a new stage, designing the bomb. At the same time, the war continued. Little by little, the Allies' success became evident. The Americans, with the support of the British, entered the mainland of Europe in the invasion of Normandy and the north of France. On August 25, 1944, Paris was liberated. In Europe, the war was in the favor of the Allies. In Asia, Japan surrounded the Assam region of India, but finally retreated. In the Pacific, America was able to defeat the Japanese forces in the Palau Islands. The naval battles between America and Japan in the Pacific Ocean ended one after another in favor of the Americans. Far from these battles, in the seemingly calm but quiet deserts of Los Alamos, nuclear scientists had come to the conclusion that they had to conduct an experiment and detonate the first bomb for test. Before carrying out that experiment, Germany was captured in April 1945. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. The managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics.
the third god, was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT. Another Jewish physicist, Isidore Isaac Rabi, predicted that the bomb would have the power of 18,000 tons of TNT. He was almost right. Isidore Isaac Rabi won that bet.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The first atomic bomb was tested at 5:29:45 a.m. Mountain War Time on July 16, 1945. The explosion almost equaled 20,000 tons of TNT. A pit with a diameter of 340 meters and a depth of 3 meters was made at the place of the explosion. Observers, who were at least 16 kilometers away from the epicenter, reported the high heat during the blast. The surrounding mountains seemed brighter than usual for a few seconds. The sky looked purple, which gradually changed to green and finally turned white. 40 seconds after the explosion, they suddenly heard its sound. The blast waves shook up to a radius of 160 kilometers. Kenneth Bainbridge, one of the test directors, remarked to J. Robert Oppenheimer immediately after the test, "Now, we are all sons of bitches." Oppenheimer later said that at the moment of seeing the first nuclear explosion, he was thinking of a passage from the mystical book of Hindu religion. In a part of the book, the Hindu god says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." At that time, Harry Truman had become president of the United States and was at Potsdam Conference. Potsdam was located in occupied Germany. Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and Harry S. Truman attended the conference. The conference was held to clarify the situation of post-war Europe and defeated Germany.
"Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered."
On the other hand, participants in the conference were waiting for the outcome of the war in the Pacific Ocean and Asia, Japan. Harry S. Truman received a coded telegram at Potsdam at 7:30 p.m. on July 16th. "Operated on this morning. Diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations." Harry S. Truman informed Stalin that America had achieved a new and powerful weapon. On July 26, 1945, the Allies issued and announced an ultimatum which outlined the terms of surrender for the Empire of Japan. The ultimatum stated that if Japan did not surrender, it would face prompt and utter destruction, but this statement did not talk about the new bomb.
"Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization. which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people, but only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing. The Americans chose the bomb, the little boy, for Hiroshima.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that President Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that former President Donald Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results, disputing the characterization of their interactions made by some members of Trump's legal team. "That's not what happened," Mike Pence said during an interview with Face the Nation that aired on Sunday, 6th of August. "From sometime in the middle of December, the president began to be told that I had some authority to reject or return votes back to the states." He added, "I had no such authority." On Tuesday, 1st of August, Donald Trump was indicted for a second time on federal charges. This most recent indictment stemmed from his efforts to remain in power after losing the 2020 presidential election, efforts which culminated in the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The indictment included four charges against Trump: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. One of the allegations against Donald Trump is that he attempted to enlist Mike Pence to use his ceremonial role in affirming the electoral vote count on 6th of January 2021 to fraudulently overturn the results of the election. Mike Pence has said Donald Trump went beyond asking him to pause the count for an audit and urged him to reject the Biden electors outright in the hopes of tipping the election in Trump's favor. There was no discretion ever given to the vice president in history, nor should there ever be, Mike Pence told Face the Nation. I had no right to overturn the election, and Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024. John Larrow, an attorney for Donald Trump, responded to Mike Pence's comments on Sunday, telling Face the Nation that his position is consistent with Pence's version of events. What I said is the ultimate ask of Vice President Pence was to pause the count and allow the states to weigh in. That was my statement, and what I've said is consistent with what Vice President Mike Pence is saying. The reason why Vice President Pence will be so important to the defense is, number one, he agrees that John Eastman, who gave legal advice to President Trump, was an esteemed legal scholar. Number two, he agrees that there were election irregularities, fraud, unlawful actions at the state level. All of that will eviscerate any allegation of criminal intent on the part of President Trump. The indictment refers to contemporaneous notes taken by the vice president in the weeks leading up to 6 of January 2021, when prosecutors alleged Trump repeatedly pressured him to reject the electoral votes. From time to time, particularly at important moments, I had a practice of scribbling a note or two on my calendar just to memorialize it and remember it, and I did that in this case, he told Face the Nation. I generally didn't make a practice of taking notes in meetings over the 4-year period of time. But given the momentous events that were unfolding, he said he took a few notes to remind himself of what had been said. From very early on, the very first time the president raised the issue with me that he was being told that I had the right to overturn the election to reject or return votes, I told him I knew I had no such authority. I truly do believe that no one who ever puts himself over the Constitution should ever be President of the United States. The former Vice President also recalled an occasion before Christmas 2020 when Donald Trump asked him what he thought we ought to do. We were just the two of us in the Oval Office, Pence said. I remember I looked at him and said, look, let all the lawsuits play out. Let the Congress do their work to consider objections. But I said at the end of the day, if the election goes the other way, I said we ought to take a bow. We ought to travel around the country, he said. And I remember the president is standing in front of his desk, listening very intently to me, and I'll never forget the way he just kind of pointed at me as if to say that's worth thinking about. Mike Pence added, but I don't know what was in his mind at the time. When asked if he would testify in the case against Donald Trump, if the case against Donald Trump went to trial, Mike Pence said he would if summoned. We'll respond to the call of the law if it comes to it, and we'll just tell the truth. He also added that he would hope that Donald Trump would receive a fair trial in the District of Columbia. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's attorney on Sunday, 6 of August, welcomed former Vice President Mike Pence potentially testifying at Trump's future trial related to his push to overturn the 2020 election. But Trump's lawyer wouldn't discuss if Trump will do the same. John Larrow argued on ABC's This Week program that Mike Pence, who is a key figure in Trump's unprecedented third indictment, could actually be beneficial to Trump, despite Mike Pence rebuking Trump for urging him to stop the certification of their defeat on 6 of January 2021, when Congress convened at the Capitol and Pence presided in a ceremonial role. John Larrow maintained that Mike Pence, if called to testify, would agree that Trump wasn't acting with criminal intent in seeking to stay in power and reverse his loss. Mike Pence will be one of our best witnesses at trial. I cannot wait until I have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Pence, Lauro told the This Week program with George Stephanopoulos. Based on what the Vice President Pence will say, the government will never be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump had corrupt or criminal intent, and that's what this case is all about, Lauro contended. Donald Trump denies breaking any laws and has pleaded not guilty to the four charges in his third indictment: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. This is a persecution of a political opponent, he claimed after his arraignment in Washington on Thursday, 3rd of August. Pressed by George Stephanopoulos on Sunday if Donald Trump would be willing to go under oath to challenge Mike Pence's version of events, John Lauro responded by saying, "That's impossible to say right now. What we have to see is what the Biden administration is going to put on as evidence." Throughout Lauro's sometimes contentious interview with George Stephanopoulos, he repeatedly insisted that federal prosecutors will struggle to prove that Donald Trump had acted corruptly because Trump was not convinced the 2020 election was legitimately conducted, a view rejected by the courts of law and election officials, and that he was seeking legal advice on the best way to challenge the results. John Lauro added, "People disagree all the time about constitutional points, but nobody gets indicted." Black and white.
El conocimiento, la experiencia histórica.
Our understanding and historical experiences have confirmed thousands of times the truthfulness of what Che Guevara proposed to us. We shall not believe imperialism at all. Imperialism's agreements and negotiations are always against the nations they oppress. 100 years have passed since the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was an agreement that aimed to put the Middle East under the dominance of two European powers.
De dos potencias principalmente europeas, todo lo que es el Oriente Medio.
I'm talking about France and Britain. These two countries simply took the power without taking into account the people, their aspirations, their desire, and their sovereignty. They marked the map and divided the area of influence and exploitation. Undoubtedly, this agreement was accompanied with treason, intrigue, bullets, bombs, and a multilateral cultural subjugation of all kinds. This phenomenon can lead us to understand the struggles of the peoples of the Middle East for their sovereignty and independence. Clearly, imperialism today is in decline. I'm referring to European imperialism. That is obviously responsible for what is happening in the Middle East. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was arranged without people's knowledge, in silence and secretly. But the agreement was kept as a secret for a year and a half because the nascent Soviet state made it public. The Lenin government announced it in two newspapers, Vestia and Pravda. But in addition to that, the Soviet state made the decision to renounce the spaces that was given to Russia, since this was a year before the Tsarist Russia was in the spaces that would correspond to them in sharing out of the Middle East. That move was a great contribution of the nascent Soviet Socialist Republic to sovereignty and independence in the Middle East. Unquestionably, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed at a time when